lying on the couch. You see how picky I am about my shoes, and they only go on my feet. Clueless, 1995. With the rise of social media, it feels like it's easy to see what tax bracket the people you follow are living in, and it's upsetting to me when the 20-something influencers are driving expensive cars and living in high-rise city apartments. Am I jealous? Unclear. I have come to learn that many times people are bamboozling their followers into thinking they are wealthier than they are, showing off designer brands while living way above their means, so it's hard to tell exactly what's going on inside their purse. Regardless, my 20s were all about saving and scraping by with the bare minimum. In college, my friends and I would save up to go to a buffet that was $3.75 for a huge dinner plate of food every Thursday. On more than one occasion, we would order our meals, sit down, and find a stray quarter in our lo mein. It happened more than once, and we still kept going because it was so cheap and filled our bellies for the day. So many students on campus would pay the $3.75 in all quarters that the establishment had loose change everywhere, including their food. I ate about $1.75 in quarters throughout my time on campus. In my early 20s, I moved out of the dorms and into a condo with my older brother Brian. He had a steady income, and the place was big with an empty loft, so he was kind enough to let me live there for free while I went to school and interned at a Cleveland morning talk show, where I was hired to get coffee for guests like Uncle Joey from Full House and a funeral home director who paid to come on the show once a month. The hosts of the show would be cooking with a local restaurateur to open the show, and then after commercial, they would sit down with someone to talk about cremation in a sponsored segment. I loved it. Anyway, although I was working my ass off, none of it was paid, so I couldn't afford things like furniture. My brother let me crash, and my parents had an old bed for me, but there was a large space in the loft that needed a couch and some tables. After moving in my stuff, my mom saw how empty the space was and offered to take me to look for couches. First up was the garage sale circuit, where we couldn't find anything. Garage sailing in Ohio is a sport, and the season ends around August, so we were at the tail end, and nothing good was left. Next up, we went to the budget stores. We walked into Big Lots and immediately went to their furniture department, which was limited in its selection, but did have a pleather sofa for $200. When I say pleather, I mean it was some slippery shit. Like a fresh trout, no matter what you were wearing, you would immediately slide off it as soon as you sat down. I think back to my youth when kids would have birthday parties at places like DZ Discovery Zone, where I would try to make it down that roller slide, injuring my butt along the way or getting my oversized hip-hop Bugs Bunny shirt caught in the wheels. No one ever slid easily. If the owners of that place really wanted children to move, they should have made a slide that was just one giant pleather couch from Big Lots. Even though the couch was cheap, I didn't care, and to be honest, I didn't even understand at the time what the difference was between real leather and whatever this was. My taste wasn't as refined as it is now. Still, I wanted it, and it cost $200, which was the absolute max I had to spend. So the employees wrapped the piece in plastic, and we put it on our truck bed to head home. Back at the condo, we drove in and noticed my oldest brother, Junior, was parked in the driveway. Junior is like a straight Italian version of Christopher Lowell. He has impeccable design style, and he's a decisive Taurus, which is helpful to my Libra-ness, so I've come to rely on him for decorating tips. When he saw that I had purchased something, he immediately unwrapped the cheap black couch to survey our choice. "You can't keep this," he said without missing a beat. "It's fine for him," Mom countered. "It looks like shit, and it's pleather." "He isn't made of money. It's fine." Mom and Junior argued in front of me about how shitty the couch was that I just spent all my savings to purchase. It was as if I weren't even there. "He's better off having nothing than this. It's a waste of $200, Junior said. I started to see that maybe this was not the right fit for my very first non-parent, non-dorm living space. Junior was right, and now I was not only regretful about the ugly-ass sofa, but I was also devastated that I wasted all the money I had on something widely regarded as hideous upon seeing it for the first time. Even my mom admitted it was crap and that she was just being nice when I opted to buy it. "Come on, get back in the truck. I'll drive you and we'll return this piece of shit," Junior said. Without even unloading it into the loft, I got in the car and we made our way back to the store. He is a much faster driver than my mother, so we made it there in record time. However, I did notice when we were on the freeway that a lot of people were honking at us, but I chalked it up to his speed. Junior pulled into the front of the store, and I ran inside while he waited in the truck. There was no reason for him to go in with me because I knew I would have to first talk to the cashier and convince them that it was an acceptable return. "I'd like to return a couch I just purchased," I said to the young employee. "What's the reason for return?" she asked. "I literally just got it about an hour ago, made a mistake," I said. "Okay, pull around to the back dock. I'll meet you there with the return slip you'll have to sign," she instructed. We pulled around, backing the truck up to the furniture dock. I hopped out and opened the truck bed just as the employee was coming outside and another was waiting with her. Junior put the truck in park, and he got out to help me unload it. The four of us looked at the couch at the exact same time, but my brother and I noticed something a split second before the employees. The cushions were no longer on the couch. It seems we may not have properly wrapped the return after all, and the people honking at us on the freeway were doing so because giant pleather cushions were falling one by one out of the back of our truck bed as my brother drove with the fervor of my old friend Roberta on her disability scooter to the discount furniture store. My mind was racing. There was no way we could retrieve three cushions from a busy Cleveland highway, but I also couldn't afford to be out the $200 it cost to buy this piece of junk. I had to think fast. "There are no cushions on this thing," the employee said. "I know! None!" I replied, confirming. "What happened to them?" "It didn't come with any," I lied. "What?" she asked. "None! No cushions on the couch! That's why I'm returning it!" "But I can't have a couch with no cushions." "You just told me in the store that it was purchased by mistake," she said. "Right. Well, I forgot to mention that it was sold to me without any cushions. I would have never bought it if I knew." Junior's face turned bright red, and I could see him biting the inside of his mouth to prevent laughter. I get that he thought it was funny, but I couldn't afford to screw this up. I shot him a look that said, "Get in the car and pull it together." So he went back into the driver's seat and let me handle the store employees. "So you want to help me pull this thing out?" I asked the employees. They were flabbergasted. I assumed no one had ever tried to return a sofa before this way, and although I was lying, it seemed like such a far-fetched lie that it had to be true. We unloaded it while my brother sat in the car and giggled like a schoolgirl. After it was unloaded, the only thing left to do was sign my return slip for the money to be refunded back onto my credit card and scurry out of there as fast as possible. Signing my name never felt so nefarious. I was a fraud, an outlaw. Looking back, I very much regret doing what I did. It's one of only two regrets I have in life, the other being my freshman year of college when I wore a cell phone belt clip. No wonder I wasn't having sex in college. My cell was on display and protruding out of my waistline, but that's a tale for another time. It was completely inappropriate of me to lie and bamboozle this store out of $200, and I knew they wouldn't be able to resell it in the shape it was in. Who's going to buy a couch with no cushions? Even so, I signed and got the hell out of there as quickly as possible. "Thank you so much. Hope you find the cushions," I said to the employees as I got into the passenger seat of the now empty truck. "Go, go, go," I told my brother as if he were a getaway car and I just robbed a bank. We drove back to the condo, and the whole way I looked out the window for those cushions, eventually seeing them in the middle of the busiest section of the freeway. For a moment, we considered stopping on the side of the road to pick them up, bring them back to the store, and confess my sins. It would have been incredibly dangerous, but perhaps still doable. Instead, we kept driving, and I waited on the edge of my seat for the refund to officially post to my account, worrying that they would change their minds and call to tell me to come collect the cushionless furniture. Years later, when I was more grown and financially stable, I would decide to start donating to the Brain and Behavioral Foundation, a fantastic mental health charity. One particular year, I made a donation on behalf of that store as a way to repent. I figured it was the least I could do, and while it might not have been as appropriate as paying them back the $200, it felt like a start. Donating to an organization that does brain research felt like the next best thing, since I mind-fucked them so hard. Does the ring mean a thing? That's your problem. You don't want to be in love. You want to be in love in a movie. Sleepless in Seattle, 1993. On Friday, June 26, 2015, the Supreme Court ruled to make same-sex marriage legal in the United States, effectively opening a whole new world of possibilities for those of us in gay relationships. I turned 30 shortly thereafter. I'm young enough that I was confident gay marriage would be legal in my lifetime, but the reality came speeding toward me like a freight train in 2015. My boyfriend and I had spent 5 years together at that point, give or take some tiny breaks where I would dramatically break up with him and spend a couple of days listening to Adele and texting other men before I would come back to my senses. We also broke up once after seeing the movie Blue Valentine simply because the movie was so intense and made me feel like true love was impossible. Or maybe it was because I thought I would eventually run off with Ryan Gosling. We're not sure. Despite the drama, I knew my boyfriend and I would eventually end up together. He's not perfect. He wears hats to special occasions. He has more collectibles than my 3-year-old niece. And he's hashtag Team Jolie and hashtag Team Kristen. I'll always be hashtag Team Aniston and hashtag Team LC. That said, he's also super smart, he continues to surprise me, he gets along with my family, and he'll listen to me talk about Katherine Heigl's old Z-Quil commercials every time I bring it up, which is approximately biweekly. If you want a lifelong partner, he's the one you want by your side. So, now that I knew I wanted to marry him and marriage was legal, I just had to figure out the next step. Easy, right? Well, not for me. Marriage is an institution that's been around forever, and because of that, there are traditions that make little to no sense when applied to me as a homosexual. These traditions sent me into a spiral that had me questioning whether or not I even wanted to get married, or if I even believed in marriage. Sure, I fought for the right for same-sex marriage, but that had more to do with equality than it did for my personal need to walk down an aisle. We are so conditioned to think that marriage equals aisle, when in reality, it doesn't have to. Which brings me to the ring situation. I started to confide in a few close friends that I was going to ask this man to marry me. Everyone had opinions about who should ask whom, but I always knew it would be me asking him, so I just had to get a band. But wait, men don't traditionally wear engagement rings. Heterosexual men usually get one for the woman to wear during the engagement period, and then they get new rings when they actually get married. It's tradition. This is where I started to question the whole institution. Why do women need 2 rings to symbolize their love? Why don't men need any? I did what any normal person would. I put on an episode of Vanderpump Rules and worked in a conversation about engagement rings while we were watching. We decided it would be weird for one person to wear an engagement ring and the other not to wear one, so that issue was settled. Now that I knew he didn't want an engagement ring, what was I going to do? If you don't have a ring to propose with, then the moment seems unofficial. I started telling my close friends that, and each time I did, it felt like I was letting them down. I could feel the judgment. They would respond with, "I guess that makes sense, but what will you do?" Everyone in my life equated proposing with an actual ring, and there was no changing them. My head became littered with their judgments, and soon my decision-making skills were compromised. I started to think I needed a ring. Because I was compromising my own beliefs to please others, I became confused. I worried that anything short of fulfilling the promise of an engagement would look like a flaw in our relationship, and I didn't want other people to think that. I knew that would lead to friends and family writing off our love, dropping hints to move on, and introducing me to potential new suitors. I internally compromised, concluding that I would get a ring to symbolize the moment, but neither one of us would be compelled to actually wear the rings after the asking. I put on another episode of Vanderpump Rules and shopped online. Turns out you can buy rings to be delivered right to your door, and they're perfectly nice and come with a wonderful return policy. Since I feel cheap even saying that sentence, please remember that I was looking for a diamondless male ring simply to symbolize a proposal and not to actually wear. I shopped as I watched the 2 Toms, and I ended up buying a black tungsten band that seemed alternative enough for my boyfriend, who is looks-wise described as creatively tattooed by my mother, and simple enough for the traditional proposal. I ordered 2, convincing myself that I should have a couple different size options, but I realize now I only bought 2 so we could have the option of Instagramming both our hands with rings on them. We live in a sick time. The rings arrived in a couple days, and now I just needed the perfect moment that would impress the people rooting for us. His birthday was coming up, and we had a trip to Mexico planned with some friends, so it seemed like the perfect opportunity. The closer we got to the vacation, the more excited I felt. I stopped worrying about the politics of rings and marriage and felt ready to commit my life to one man. I even had time to plan personal touches without the influence of others in my head. He likes Legos, so I had some little Lego guys made to look like us, complete with the cute little Lego tuxes. The plan was to give the Lego men to him, and then when he questioned why they were in tuxes, I could present the ring and say, "Will you marry me?" I didn't have the other details or words planned out, but I knew they would come to me when we got to Mexico. His birthday week finally arrived, and we packed for our Cabo San Lucas getaway. I've never been to Mexico, but I assumed it would be exactly like the Sex and the City movie, where the girls take Carrie's honeymoon trip after Big fails to show up on time to the altar. Perhaps it was because I associated Mexico with Carrie drama, but as soon as we landed, I started to feel internally crazy, and things took a dark turn for me emotionally. All those people I told about our special moment were texting or calling to find out the details, asking me when I was going to ask him to marry me. All the pressure froze me and caused me to panic. I was putting on a brave face, but inside I felt like Carrie when she couldn't eat anything and Samantha has to come in and feed her pudding. I wished I had someone to feed me pudding because instead I ate all the food at the all-inclusive resort, which led to a stomach parasite. So romantic. Regardless, I called my mom for some guidance. Mom tried to calm me down, and in between trips to the bathroom, I did my best to psych myself up for the proposal. Lots of other friends were calling and texting, asking me how it was going to go. I couldn't back out now, but I did finally snap. In the words of the poster for Snapped, an Oxygen series, everyone has a breaking point. I texted all my people to stop asking me anything about the engagement, and I retreated to my hotel room. The next day was his actual birthday, and we had group dinner plans. Everyone was expecting me to quiet the room and get down on one knee at the restaurant, but I refused. Instead, just the two of us went back to the room after dinner and stripped down to our more comfortable outfits, oversized house shirts and underwear. Without anyone else around, I went to the bathroom one last time, a mix of nerves and that nasty stomach parasite. When I went back into the main room, I saw my boyfriend lying in the hotel bed, playing a word game on his iPad, and everything became clear again. It was just him and me, alone, and a sense of calm came over me. The nerves were still there, but buried a little deeper. Stronger than that, though, was the assuredness that his love would make everything okay. In that moment, I felt like I could lose everything else, my home, my money, my stuff. It wouldn't matter as long as I didn't lose him. I told him to close his eyes, and I put the little Lego guys in his hands. He opened his eyes and smiled. For a few seconds, his lips curled upward, he flashed his beautiful teeth and inspected the two of us in Lego form. Like a child, he played with them as if they really were me and him. Just like my niece would do, he put the little arms together and made them kiss. I hadn't even asked him to marry me yet, but in that moment, he said yes. It was in his eyes that he wanted to be with me forever, and the fact that I wanted to be with him forever was radiating from my own. None of that other stuff mattered. That was the moment for us when we got engaged. I followed by getting on one knee and pulling out the ring I bought online. I asked him, he said yes. That was the moment for everyone else. The ring part of the story was enough to please our friends and family when we went back to tell them, but the moment before was enough to please me when I look into his eyes again in 20 or 30 or 40 years. The entire experience made me realize that love, marriage, and tradition are meant to bend, to be flexible. You can't propose for other people or fall in love the way you see in the movies. After I saw the warmth in his eyes, I made a conscious effort to strive to do everything in our own way. Instead of rushing to call or tell other people, we celebrated the way we wanted. We lay in that Mexican hotel bed, ordered room service, and watched HBO's The Comeback, which is the greatest TV show ever, on an iPad. I put my head on his chest, relieved that nothing changed. We eventually got around to posting an update online and calling our friends and family. Their love and support was appreciated, but it didn't mean as much to me as it did before. We have no plans to get married at the moment, but we do have a commitment that we understand and that I'm glad I made. It turns out the ring didn't mean a thing after all. Let's take a little detour. A good loved one is always just a phone call away. Phone calls with Mom are usually me ringing her when I lose a job opportunity or when my boyfriend and I get in a fight. Really any big life moment. Half the time she'll answer her cell from the grocery store or a TJ Maxx because she too is a certified Maxinista. Like clockwork, she gets distracted by the world around her, even if she answers my call from her own home. "Hello?" she'll say as she picks up my call. My anxiety is really bad right now. I'm not sure what I should do about... Hold on, Dan. That bold-ass woodpecker's back at the window. Gary! The bold-ass woodpecker's back at the window! Here I was, thinking she would simply pause the competition for the mirror ball trophy that she was watching and focus on me. Is now a bad time, Ma? No, I can talk, but this bold-ass woodpecker's driving me nuts. It pecks at the window. Bop, 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 bop. I can't hear it anymore. I'm sick of it. But I'm good now. I'm good. What do you need, Dan? It's the ring. Hold on, Dan. Your Aunt Joanne is calling on the house phone. Joe? Yeah, I can't talk long. Dan's on the other phone. But you'll never guess who's back. The bold-ass woodpecker. I'm gonna have to start charging it rent. You know what? I'm gonna have to call you back, Joe. Dan's on the other line. Dan, sorry, that was your Aunt Joanne. Had to tell her about the woodpecker. These critters are going to have to start paying the mortgage. We got a deck squirrel, a slinky cat that's been coming around. Your Aunt Joanne's got a smiley raccoon that's always smiling. You know what it's smiling about? It gets to live rent-free, she says, then turns her attention to my father. Gary, go spray the window with Windex to get it out of here, or at least ask it for a rent check because it acts like it owns the joint. You know Debbie next door feeds the critters? She's got a bird feeder, and I saw her put out a plate of food. Leftovers, Dan. And they still come to my yard, not hers. Imagine if I started feeding the critters here. It'd be a zoo. I'd have a Noah's Ark if I put out my world-famous potato salad. Anyway, what does my Danster need? She finally asks. It's... Hold on, Dan. Gary, you're at the wrong window. She shouts at my father through the glass. Your father's at the wrong window. I gotta go out there and tell him. I mean, he's cleaning the window. At least I finally got him doing that. But I need that bold-ass woodpecker gone. They don't like the smell of Windex, so it goes away when you spray around it. You know what? I better go. Congrats, I hope everything's okay. Love ya, she says, hanging up on me and leaving me with no choice but to smile. As I get older, I see that we're all in our own little worlds, dealing with not just the big life events, but also the minutiae of an everyday existence. Our friends and family may want us to give them their undivided attention, but it's not always possible. As life gets busier and busier, I'm grateful to have people in my life who will answer no matter what the circumstance. I count myself lucky to know that I have even just a handful of family and friends I can call in the middle of the night, the break of dawn, or when a bold-ass woodpecker is at their window. Wedding exercise. I go online, and my breath catches in my chest until I hear three little words. You've got mail. You've got mail. 1998. Like I said, weddings bring out the absolute worst in people. It's supposed to be a time of love, celebration, and gathering with the people closest to you, but really it is a time when humans become the most berserk, selfish version of themselves, all the while wearing rented clothes and dancing to shout. By the end of the reception, someone's Uncle Larry is shouting at you because his table was placed right next to a speaker that ruined his already bad hearing. You're trying to pat your pits dry while Uncle Larry's inability to get a little bit softer now has you checking for the shuttle bus back to the hotel. While the ceremony and reception is a lot to handle, it's the buildup to the special day that has me questioning humanity. If you've ever been part of a wedding party, specifically the bridal side, you know what I'm talking about. I've had the misfortune of being part of four weddings during my short time here on Earth. The first came when I was 18 and brother number one was tying the knot. I shared best man duties, and my only real responsibility was showing up to the bachelor party, which consisted of a weekend in Vegas with the other groomsmen and the bridal party, as well as a woman nicknamed Gina Rails, who I'm still not certain had any connection to the group. She received her moniker by taking her first name and putting it in front of the word Rails, because she was known for proudly doing rails of cocaine at any given moment. Seeing a young woman on coke at a Vegas breakfast brunch buffet was a lot for my teenage eyes to handle. I'll never forget Killing Me Softly playing over the loudspeaker and her shouting along while we were in line for heat-lamped scrambled eggs. An older gentleman was behind me and simply said, "She's killing me loudly with that voice," as he reached for a sausage link using the pancake tongs. An icon. Brother number two's wedding also found me in the best man position. This time I was in my mid-20s, and instead of a bachelor party weekend, we opted for one night out in downtown Cleveland. It wasn't just the groomsmen who joined this party. It was also my dad and uncles, all of whom are married already, celebrating together at a strip club. Married people, in my experience, act one of two ways at a strip club. They either get way too into the dancers, dropping all their money in hopes that one of the women will magically decide to leave with them and start a new life, or the married guys awkwardly fumble around, doing their best to prove they have zero interest in the bubbies around them. For this occasion, we got a VIP table and a bunch of booze, and at this establishment, the dancers come to the VIP to try to coerce the men into getting a private dance, where they in turn earn more money. One of the gals asked my dad for a private show, and he falls into the awkward category. You see, Dad had become newly obsessed with his Nike Fuel Band, which were all the rage at the time, so when the woman was flirtatiously questioning him about a special dance, he was checking his steps and telling her how his new gadget works. Their convo went something like this. "Hey, stud, do you want a private dance? I'm kind of busy right now checking my fuel points. I did a long walk earlier, but I still need a few more steps. Might have to take a lap around this place. Do you know the circumference? You know what? Don't worry about it. I can measure it on my app. Why don't you go ahead and ask one of these other guys?" It's a good thing he met my mother in the 1970s. The young lady moved on to me, and I quickly told the stripper that although I respect her craft, the only sexual dancing I'm interested in seeing up close is the I'm a Slave for You choreography from Britney's self-titled album. Would have also settled for something from the Oops, I Did It Again era. This one singular night out was pretty much all I had to do for brother number two's wedding. There was very little pre-planning, no decorations or group texts. However, I came to find out a few years later that being in a bridal party is much different than being a groomsman. Bridal parties are fully deranged. First of all, I don't believe anyone wants to be in a bridal party. If you're out there and you're getting married or in the process of getting married, you could pretend your friends and family want to be in your wedding, but I'm here to tell you that they don't. There are exceptions to every rule, of course, but you brides make your friends go through too many hoops in addition to just the bachelorette party. Plus, the bachelorette party is very different than a bachelor party. Straight men are happy to simply see some bare breasts and have a beer. Hell, gay men just need a male stripper dancing to Pony or Christina Aguilera's Dirty to be satisfied. But straight women require games, decorations, and hundreds of dollars of dick merch. Dick straws, dick lollipops, dick balloons, dick-cetera. Before they're ready to move on to the ceremony. It should be noted that it's not just the bride who is troublesome. The entire group ends up being a mess. There's always at least one person in the bridal party who's going to be the puker. They drink too much and throw up at every single wedding event. I'm talking vomit with the strippers, vomit at the engagement party, vomit at the rehearsal dinner. They're the ones who refuse to eat on the wedding day and force the limo party bus to pull over so they can upchuck on the way to the church. You offer them a handful of pretzels and a couple of almonds, but they decline only to hurl an inexplicable amount of champagne at the side of a limousine. Whenever a bride is late, I don't even consider cold feet. I always just assume it's because a girl named Brooke didn't space out her shamps and is making everyone wait for her to clean the sick off her dress with an old Tide pen someone tossed in their purse before leaving the hotel that morning. In addition, the bridal party stuff is all so expensive. I think parties are great, but weddings have gotten out of hand and the entire industry needs to be stopped. Enough! A couple years back, wedding number four was up and running. A friend was getting hitched and graciously asked me to be her man of honor. She's one of my all-time favorite people, and if it were literally anyone else, I would have said no. But I put on a smile and agreed to handle my business as a bestie, because I love her more than almost anyone on the entire planet. While I had been in weddings before, this was my first time in the number one position on the bride's side, so I had a lot to learn. The bride's sister was kind enough to help with the organizing and other responsibilities, so together we planned a bachelorette weekend in New Orleans, and I ordered my outfit for the wedding photos. A couple weeks before we were all set to go to NOLA to celebrate, the pandemic hit. All the dick merch I bought was non-refundable, but there were more important things happening in the world to worry about. With the deadly pandemic in full effect, I expected no one in the wedding party to be concerned with the canceled bachelorette weekend, but I was wrong. Emails continued to flood in those early days as no one was certain just how long life would be on lockdown. My boyfriend lost his job. I lost a lot of my work, just as many others around the world did. But the emails about wedding activities continued through it all. I didn't even know if we would all safely make it out of 2020, so the last thing on my mind was wedding stuff. The day my boyfriend lost his paycheck was the same day I lost one of my main paid gigs for the year. At night, an email came in from Patricia, one of the women from the bridal party, suggesting that we do something special for the bride and groom in lieu of the canceled weekend of bridal party fun in Louisiana. "I hate that we're going to have to reschedule the bachelorette party. We should do something to cheer them up," she wrote. That's a beautiful idea in theory, but remember, I am broke at this point and barely hanging on to my sanity. I was locked in a tiny apartment with my unemployed significant other, binging RuPaul's Drag Race as my hair grew to unspeakable lengths and I obsessively washed my hands every 5 seconds, wondering when I'd ever get to see my family again. I had an empty bank account and I was on the edge. As I continued reading the email, I expected to see the suggestion of sending a nice card or a small floral arrangement, but instead Patricia suggested that we all buy the bride and groom a Peloton. A Peloton bike. Don't get me wrong, I love those fancy exercise bikes with the screens attached, and as far as I'm concerned, instructor Cody Rigsby is a national hero, but these pieces of equipment are pricey, and this woman was not suggesting we pitch in and get it in place of a wedding gift. No, no, we were still expected to do a bachelorette weekend once the country opened up, as well as the engagement gift, wedding gift, tux rental, etc. And don't forget all those non-refundable schlong straws I bought. Peloton Patty was simply suggesting it as an additional gift since the bride was inconvenienced in having to postpone the pre-party bachelorette weekend because of the deadly pandemic that at this point had changed the course of history as we knew it. All the emotion I had been bearing deep regarding the state of the world, the sadness of not being able to see my family, wondering how I was going to pay rent, and the uncertainty of our nation's future came bubbling up to the surface as I read that message asking me to buy someone a Peloton. Now, I've never been a confrontational person. Ordinarily, I spend my days thinking about what I wish I would have said to someone who wronged me instead of actually saying any of those things. I win so many of the imaginary fights in my head, but they often stay there. My brain was in overdrive and my hands were shaking as I clicked the reply button. I did my absolute best not to explode my anger onto the screen. I wished I had the strength to respond with exactly how I felt, but I bit my tongue. The email response I typed was polite, stating that I thought it was insensitive to ask me and the other people in the bridal party to chip in to buy a piece of exercise equipment for the bride when so many have lost their jobs and/or are dealing with illness and the general hell of 2020. Very kindly, I suggested that perhaps, maybe, if anyone has any extra money, they could donate it to a worthy cause instead of pitching in for an exercise bike. Easy breezy. None of the snappy comebacks playing inside my head made it to the final draft, which I thought was a good thing. I was keeping the peace. Or so I thought. After I clicked send, I got another email, this time from a boss at a writing gig I had been hired for. They informed me that although I had already done a lot of work on the project, they wouldn't be able to pay me. I snapped. I hopped on over to Twitter where I voiced my actual frustration, like the petty millennial I am, about the wedding. After all, I couldn't vent about the job drama because I didn't want to burn any professional bridges. Instead, I let my feelings about the exercise bike and the insanity of bridal parties ooze out of me for the entire timeline to ingest. Big mistake. Huge. The straights are crazy when it comes to weddings. Someone just asked me to buy a Peloton for a bride because the pandemic is causing them to reschedule the bachelorette party, I tweeted. I continued into a thread of details, making sure not to include any specific names, but dragging the events nonetheless. It wasn't even the bike so much as all of my feelings being let out at once on something that it made sense for me to be mad about. It's never about what it's about. The likes on Twitter started coming in fast and furious. Celebrities who follow me on social media were replying things like, "What the hell is wrong with people?" Every time someone hearted my tweets, I felt a validation that I wasn't crazy for thinking it was a weird ask. I felt at peace. Briefly. Less than 5 minutes from when I posted, I got a ding on my computer. A new email came in, this time from Peloton Patty's boyfriend. "Tweeting about my girlfriend is a dick move. She has a real job and all you do is tell jokes for a living," he said. I felt like Carrie Bradshaw when she got an instant message on her computer in Sex and the City. She ducked for cover, worrying that someone could see her. Keep in mind, I had never met either of these people in person, and I had no idea they even followed me on Twitter. I didn't even understand how the boyfriend had my email address. Doesn't matter, they were both pissed. Before I could even catch my breath, the phone rang. It was the bride. "Did you tweet something about Patricia asking you to buy a Peloton?" she asked in that shaky voice that makes me nervous. "What? What are you talking about?" I replied, knowing exactly what she was talking about, but trying to buy myself time to assess the severity of the situation. At this point, I felt all my bowels lower. "She's crying right now, so upset. Can you delete the tweets?" she said. And just like that, I became the doggone villain. A stranger asked me to collect all my coins to buy a bride a Peloton in the midst of the deadliest pandemic since 1918, and I was now feeling bad for saying how I felt to my close friends. Twitter. I've been known to expunge my tweets a time or two. I consider the ones I anxiously delete within a few minutes of posting to be exclusives that are only available for a limited time. Of course, I ended up deleting these specific wedding tweets, but not because of Peloton Patty. I did it because my best friend asked me to, and those are the rules. In the build-up to your friend's wedding, you have to do whatever they want, no matter what. In retrospect, I should have screenshotted the emails they sent and called them out by name on Twitter. That's what social media is for. You voice your frustrations, which is what I was doing. It's a burn book. Not only that, but that the boyfriend was so bossy and reduced my profession in saying that all I do is tell jokes for a living. Why was he even getting involved with the bridal party drama? Doesn't he watch The Real Housewives? The men should never get in the mix. And why did the couple call the bride and groom about all this nonsense? There was no reason to stress them out, as they already had enough on their plate, what with their postponed wedding and the 2020 trauma we were all collectively going through. The bride and groom canceled their big plans and instead did a small ceremony at a courthouse, and I never came face to face with my new arch nemesis, Peloton Patty, or her boyfriend. Part of me was relieved because seeing this couple that I had such a tense and awkward email exchange with would have been more than uncomfortable. The downside was that I didn't get to see my best friend say I do to the man she loves. As cynical as I may be about weddings, I love seeing love. Fingers crossed they still have a fondness for me after hearing this chapter about the events that unfolded via email and social media. They also ended up buying their own exercise bike in place of a honeymoon, and while I may simply tell jokes for a living, those strangers both followed me on Twitter without ever actually meeting me in person, so they must like at least some of my humor. I like to think that 2020 was making us all crazy, and maybe I will someday see Peloton Patty and Bossy Boyfriend, and we can laugh the whole experience off over cocktails. After all, how can any of us be held accountable for our words or actions throughout that hellscape? Or maybe they're listening to this audiobook and hate me even more for continuing on this saga. Perhaps it all would have been avoided if I acted more like Berger than I did Carrie in Sex and the City by simply replying to that initial email with, "I'm sorry, I can't. Don't hate me." Or maybe if I would have just changed the subject like my dad did with that beautiful exotic dancer, I could have gone for a walk and got my steps in instead of getting tangled in online drama. Friday Night Lights. This is not a democracy. It's a cheerocracy. Bring it on, 2000. Friday night football games are a huge deal when you grow up in Solon, Ohio. Everyone gathers to watch the varsity team play, all the while the cheer team plasters on smiles and waves their pom-poms at everyone sitting on the bleachers. If I close my eyes, I can picture myself as a young kid underneath those bleachers, listening to the feet stomp above me in unison, the smell of cheap nacho cheese in the air, and the crisp, chill sweatshirt weather. I'm not a football fan, but I'd give anything to go back and relive one of those evenings where the only care in the world is whose house you were going to sleep at that night, or whether or not you were going to make it to Applebee's after the game to split one order of chicken tenders with 11 other teens. When I was 15, just a couple months into my high school experience, I would drive to the field with my folks, and they would sit with some adult friends while I would venture off into the student section with the other high school kids. The student area was tiered off, so seniors had the best seats, freshmen had the worst, and just about everyone was sneaking beer in water bottles or flasks they hid under blankets. The nights were always about more than sports. They were about the socializing and drama. Games of telephone would echo throughout the stands, with teenage whispers filling the air. Who liked whom and who was breaking up with whom? Throughout the week, students would create their storylines between classes, and Friday night football games would be where it all climaxed, where the dirty laundry was aired. I wouldn't say I was a loser by any means, but I was B-list at best, so I mostly observed. It might be hard to tell since you're all listening to an audiobook about me, but I've never loved attention. It's okay when I have complete control over it, but that's such a rare occurrence, and I particularly loathe it when it comes to anything regarding romance or sexuality. Growing up closeted, I never felt comfortable in my own skin. People often ask me when I knew I was gay, and the truth is, I always kind of knew, but I was raised in a place where there weren't many, if any, LGBTQ+ people around me. Being that there were no real-life examples, I worked hard to convince myself that the inklings I had about being gay weren't real or substantial. To add to that, teenage hormones are so aggressive that it's hard to know what or who you like. Did I want to hook up with the other young women at my school, or did I want to play MASH and theorize what it was like behind the scenes of the Vanity Fair cover shoot that featured the Olsen twins, Hilary Duff, Lindsay Lohan, Raven Simone, Mandy Moore, Evan Rachel Wood, Alexis Bledel, and Amanda Bynes on the cover? It was the latter, but I didn't quite know it yet. Let's take a little detour. Remember when Saved by the Bell did the Malibu Sands Beach Club episodes? The sight of Zach Morris in a sleeveless neon blouse left me weak at the knees, and when he and Mario Lopez took off their tops to play volleyball, I salivated. But for every time I got Twitter-pated by those two, I would also get the feels for Kelly Kapowski or Lisa Turtle in a bathing suit. I was so excited, so scared that I was attracted to everyone, and that confused the crap out of me when it came to my sexuality. Looking back, there were so many seminal moments from both genders that got my heart racing, but it was mostly about the men. Here are more than a few examples that come immediately to mind. Devon Sawa and Casper. He only appeared for a couple of minutes, but seeing his perfect hair slow dance with Christina Ricci to a Jordan Hill ballad was one of the first times I remember being attracted to the same gender. When I saw him pop up in Now and Then, underrated, the same year, I was fully crushed, and his role in Little Giants made me want to play football, or at least rewatch the football-themed film again and again and again. Rebecca Gayhart in 90210, one of the most beautiful humans ever, and her gorgeous eyes on screen in 90210 confused the hell out of me. I'll never ever forget when her character, spoiler alert, died. I cried so much that night. Josh Hartnett. Even though his hair in the 90s made it look like he got in a fight with a weed whacker, he was still stunning. His neck mole was and remains very influential to my development. Queer as Folk US. The original UK version is superior, but during my high school years, I discovered the drama on Showtime in the basement of my parents' house after they were asleep. The Brian-Justin romance was my gay lighthouse. Tyson Beckford. Woo! 5 stars. Remember when he did the Toni Braxton video? The Lawrence brothers, in that Disney Channel original movie where they were shipwrecked and blouseless, in the immortal words of Joey and Blossom, whoa! Denise Richards in Wild Things. Before her 2-season arc on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Denise lit up the screen in some serious classic films. While my favorite movie of hers is Drop Dead Gorgeous, it was her tour de force in Wild Things that really made me question everything. I truly believe that the hotness of Denise in that film knows no bounds. Bonus points for the Kevin Bacon shower scene at the end. Tony Danza in Who's the Boss? Kurt Russell as Captain Ron. Eric Nies from The Real World. I actually didn't watch his season of The Real World until recently. Heather B. is now my everything, but I remember Eric's abs frequently appearing on MTV during the early 90s and young me being so enamored. Other Real World alum who got me going include Alton from Las Vegas, Colin from Hawaii, and Danny from New Orleans. Speaking of MTV, special shout out to the spring break coverage, specifically the episode of Jerry Springer that was filmed at a beach and aired on MTV featuring men with whipped cream bikinis. Aladdin and Prince Eric from The Little Mermaid. Keanu Reeves in Speed, specifically the second half when he's wearing just a white tee, but also every frame of Keanu Reeves in anything. Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman, one of the greatest performances ever, so good that anyone who saw it was attracted to her. The scene where she dances with Michael Keaton in Batman Returns, a moment. Cuba Gooding Jr. when he hosted SNL and did a sketch where he stripped for the Mango character. Various Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, specifically Tommy, Jason, and Adam the Black Ranger in the feature film when he was assigned the Frog Zord. Johnny Young Bosch really awakened something within me in that moment. The Kimberly envy within was also real. Chris Evans' Flaunt magazine photo shoot. Google it. Leonardo DiCaprio in The Beach. I rented that movie from my local library upwards of 85 times, and I can't tell you what it's about, but Leo was tan and rarely wearing a top. 5 stars. Tom Welling as Superman. Janet Jackson in the If video. Ricky Martin with the candle wax in the Livin' La Vida Loca video. The Playgirl paparazzi photos of Brad Pitt from the late 90s, which were allegedly the inspo for Shania Twain singing about him not impressing her much. Brad always impresses me. Ryan Phillippe. I already mentioned him in this audiobook, but it bears repeating that his butt is one of the most important butts of all time. Cruel Intentions is the most well-known performance of his butt, but 54 also has an iconic butt shot. Ryan also has a shower scene in I Know What You Did Last Summer that, although it doesn't show off his assets, it was very important to me and leads me to the final piece of my sexual confusion puzzle. Jennifer Love Hewitt. She was the girl next door and a bombshell, although my crush was completely non-sexual. Unlike the others I mentioned, JLH didn't rev up my sex engine. She just seemed like someone I wanted to marry. I first fell in love with her in Party of Five, but my love continued with I Know What You Did Last Summer, and I still know what you did last summer, plus her music and more. I even watched the Party of Five spinoff she did with Jennifer Garner, hashtag justice for time of your life, and bought her album, hashtag justice for bare naked. The point is, I was in love. Eventually, J-Love would be a guest on my podcast, and interviewing her was a real moment for me. I had her poster on my wall, and she was suddenly in my kitchen, and let me tell you, she was a delight. I'm not sure if she would even remember me since celebs do so much press, but she was kind, warm, and even willing to recreate her iconic line, "What are you waiting for?" from I Know What You Did Last Summer. I was truly blessed. Anyway, my crush on Jennifer Love Hewitt was real back then, and when I met a girl named Sarah who looked like the spitting image of her, I was convinced she was going to be the love of my life. The first time I met her was at an open house I went to with my parents. Sarah's family was moving to town, and I happened to meet her at the house her family ultimately moved into. My parents loved to go to open houses just for fun, which used to sound boring to me, but now that I'm an adult and spending roughly 3 hours a night browsing Zillow with a bottle of bed wine, I get it. Just a few short weeks after that meeting, Sarah and I would be going to the same school. I got home that day after the open house, ran up to my bedroom, and listened to Brandy's Have You Ever on repeat for about 6 hours, dreaming of starting my life with her, having kids, and becoming Mr. Sarah, or whatever the proper equivalent of that is. For the most part, Sarah and I never spoke more than 3 words to each other. I'd say hi or ask how she was, she would respond, and then I would run away with heart palpitations. Every time we talked, my voice would shake, my eyes would twitch, and I would sweat even more than normal. My body was like a waterfall. She made me incredibly nervous, and saying more than a few words to her was entirely too much for me to handle. Plus, she was one of the most popular kids in school despite being a new student. She was that good looking. All that's to say that one Friday night, I decided I was going to talk to Sarah and invite her to the fall dance. I'm not sure where I got the nerve to think that she would go with me since she was A-list and I was the kid who listened to a Brandy ballad for 6 hours straight on more than one occasion, but I digress. Did I mention I also dressed up like the Have You Ever music video, using cherry-flavored Airheads candy to give me a bold lip to recreate Brandy's look? The point is, I was confident and delusional, which is how I would describe most of my youth until this time. For days leading up to me asking her to the dance, I obsessed over how I would do it and what she might say. I'd roleplay, pretending Sarah was an inflatable green alien that I won at a carnival game, analyzing every possible outcome, planning out what I would wear, and daydreaming about what I would say if she said yes. While I knew there was a possibility that she would turn me down, the reward far outweighed the risk. School was rough that Friday, since I wasn't able to concentrate on anything other than my weekend plans. My brother and I were the same height, so most of my clothes were his hand-me-downs. Every once in a while, he would let me wear some of his more current stuff, and this particular night, I asked him to help dress me. He gave me something I definitely couldn't pull off, sprayed me with half a bottle of Nautica cologne, and let me borrow some of his hair gel, which was the kind that turns your hair into a rock. Remember in Hocus Pocus when Bette Midler turns to stone as the sun rises? That's basically what happened when I put that gel in my hair. Actually, I wish I looked as good as Queen Bette when she was made of stone. I was addicted to acne cream at the time, and my hair was prematurely gray, so the combination of my dry skin and graying hair made me look more like that Hocus Pocus zombie who wakes up on Halloween and coughs dust. Even though my brother helped dress me, he had no plans to go to the football game. He was a freshman in college nearby, so he was way too cool to go to his old high school's game. Instead, I once again drove with my parents, who were excited to hang with some of the other parents under a blanket while watching football. We arrived at the field and assumed our usual routine. Mom and Dad went to meet their friends while I met mine. "Meet us down by the concessions at the end of the game," Mom said. While there were cell phones at the time, the Pellegrino family only had one that we all shared. Nowadays, even my 8-year-old niece has a cell, but pre-millennium, pre-willennium, the Will Smith album that featured a song called Will 2K, they weren't as common. For the first half of the football game, I anxiously ran around with my friends, stress-eating concession hot dogs and reconsidering my plans to ask Sarah on a date. During halftime, I saw her with her bestie giggling in my direction, and I worried they were both making fun of me. I was convinced that someone must have told her I was going to ask her to the dance, and now she had plenty of time to plan her way of saying no, along with making fun of me for even thinking she would go with me. You ever hear those stories about people able to lift a car in moments of strength, adrenaline giving them what they need to do impossible tasks? That's what happened to me in the third quarter. Her friend went off to the bathroom or something, and I noticed Sarah was standing solo. This was my shot, and I wasn't going to miss it. I confidently walked up and stood next to her, always keeping one eye on the field as if I gave a shit about what was happening in the game. "Hi, Sarah." "Hi," she replied. "I love football," I lied, hoping to spark conversation. "Me too." "So, the fall formal is coming up, and..." Sarah smiled warmly, and I felt like I was in, like she would say yes. My confidence shot through the roof immediately after I saw her flash her pearly whites. I took a beat, steadied my breath, and took both eyes off the field to look into her beautiful blues just as I heard an announcement over the loudspeaker.
"Danny Pellegrino, your parents are looking for you," the announcer said for everyone in the stadium to hear.
I was mortified, but determined to keep my cool in front of Sarah. "That's you," Sarah said. "No shit. Do you need to go?" she asked. No, I'm sure it's fine. I'll go later," I assured. So about the dance, I was thinking..." Before I could finish my sentence, I heard a more familiar voice echoing throughout the stadium. It was my mother.
"Dan, it's your mother. We have to leave early, so come down to the concession stand. Danster?
Can you hear me, Danster? She said, her voice trailing off as the mic was taken from her hands. You hear that, Danster? The announcer said with a laugh before getting back to the football game. It was a nightmare. The entire student section looked over at me, laughing and pointing. While I wanted to run and hide, there was still a part of me trying to remain calm in front of the girl of my dreams. If I ran out of the stands in tears, I knew I would never recover. I'd be the kid no one wanted to befriend because he cried like a baby at the football game. Instead, I kept a smile on my face and laughed along with the other kids. It's always better to laugh at yourself before others do, and if you can't do it before them, do it with them. Psychologically, it might not be great for one's self-esteem, but it takes some of the power away from the bullies. Does your mom always call you Danster? Sarah asked. Yeah, it's an inside joke thing. What's the joke? She followed up. Truth is, it wasn't an inside joke. It was just something my mom called me since I was a young kid. One of those nicknames that stuck. It only occasionally snuck out of her mouth in public. Unfortunately, this time it happened over a microphone for the entire city to hear. Yeah, you know, I better get going, I told Sarah, resigning the idea of finishing my mission and asking her to the dance. That ship had sailed. My only goal at this point was to walk off the bleachers, tell my parents I was never speaking to them again, and have them drive me home so I can listen to 6 more hours of a Brandy ballad, eat the stack of Airheads I hid under my mattress, and then cry again in the shower. I walked toward the exit, feeling low but keeping my head held high. I didn't want anyone to see how hurt I was that they were laughing and throwing metaphorical pig's blood on me like they did to Carrie at her prom or in Jawbreaker when the crowd tossed corsages at Rose McGowan. Seconds felt like hours as I inched my way toward the bottom of the bleachers near the exit. On my way out, I heard the familiar sounds of the cheer squad, who set up shop right in front of the student section, spending the football game encouraging all students to root for the home team. Unfortunately, they took a break from school spirit to drag me with an improvised cheer in perfect formation. Ready? Okay, I heard the squad scream. Danster, your parents are looking for you. Hey, your parents are looking for you. Hey, they sang, finishing with one final Danster, Danster. It didn't quite rhyme, but it was impressive nonetheless that they were able to make up something on the spot like that. Horrifying for me, though. Sometimes I close my eyes at night and hear the chant playing over and over again in my head, wincing at the embarrassment of it all. More laughs from the student section followed, along with some finger-pointing from some parents and teachers that I knew, as I ran out of that stadium and made my way to the Brandy album as quickly as time would allow. Sarah and I never went to any dances together. She eventually transferred schools and we lost touch, but I'll never forget that football game and what a bunch of assholes the other students were, as well as the cheerleading team and the townspeople. Kids can be cruel, and while I understand that others have had it way worse, I can't help but think about how I felt that night. The confidence I had going into that game was forever changed as I was leaving. Any time I would try to flirt with the girl after that, a familiar feeling of embarrassment would wash over me. There were a handful of years where I dated girls and pretended to be straight, but my flirt game never recovered until I came out of the closet. The scars of our childhood never fully go away, and although we grow and learn, we never forget those wounds. Surely Sarah doesn't remember any of it, and Danster was, fortunately, not a nickname that stuck with my classmates. What did stick is the feeling of not being good enough. But looking back now, I realize that I was good enough. I am good enough, and very lucky that I had 2 parents who were looking for me. Now that I'm older, I still rely on Brandy to get through the tough times, only now I pair the Full Moon album with another Brandy, Cognac. The Rain. Nothing like a rainy day to reflect on what a mess your life is, huh? Julie Cooper, The OC. It's always dicey when a loved one starts dating someone new. You could hate their latest significant other, they could hate you, or even worse, indifference. Indifference is the real sniper from the side, because if you don't like the person and don't hate the person, you have little energy to want to make any effort at all to spend time with them.
Fortunately, both of my brothers ended up with women I adore like they are my own sisters, but it wasn't so easy to get where we're at now. When Brian started dating his now wife, I was still living with him. We were a brotherly duo who spent a lot of time together, and being that we were in our 20s, we had a lot of fun being friends as well as family. No matter who he started dating at the time, it was going to be an adjustment for me and my relationship with him. He slowly started to bring his new girlfriend around more as they got to know each other, and all signs pointed to her being wonderful, so my focus was entirely on making sure that she liked me. This meant buttering her up with compliments, ordering extra food when I got takeout so she would feel included, and warming up to her dog, Teddy. Teddy was the key to the whole relationship, as all pets are. If you want their owner to like you, just treat the dog like royalty. Easy enough, right? Dogs should be treated as such regardless, but particularly when there's an added layer of impressing their parent. Teddy started to come to our shared condo more and more, just as my brother started falling more and more in love with Teddy's owner. They would both spend weekends at the house, but typically Teddy would go wherever they went if they left the house. He was a small dog, so he's easily able to hop on someone's lap and take a drive, but there was one Friday night they decided to leave him at the condo with me. Brian made their date night plans for dinner and a movie, and I offered to hang with the pooch while they were gone. It was an unusually chaotic weather night for Northeast Ohio, as there was a hail-rain mix happening outside. I had just bought the first three seasons of Entourage on DVD, so I planned on having a quiet night in with Turtle and the gang, steering clear of the mess outdoors. Before you all judge me, just know that I'm opening my heart to you, and although Entourage is not looked back on very fondly by many today, it was at the time a critical HBO darling. We all watched it, so stop! Stop judging me, please! Anyway, they left for their date, I fired up the DVD player, watched a few eps with some ramen, and enjoyed my low-key evening. Unfortunately, while I was enjoying Vince and Drama's crazy Hollywood antics, I spilled some soup on my shirt like the dummy I am. Our washer-dryer was located right by the door that led to the garage, which is where Teddy spent most of his time, waiting for his mama to return from her date. I decided to do a full load of laundry, so I carried my basket of clothes to the area and put them in the machine. At that point, Teddy hadn't quite warmed up to me yet, constantly barking at my mere presence, and I don't fault him for it. Without getting into too much detail about his rescue story, he wasn't a big fan of male energy. Who among us is, really? He was also fiercely protective of his owner, so anytime anyone was near her and he could see them, he would bark and bark and bark. Teddy woofed at me as I put my clothes in the washer, but I did my best to ignore it. My plan was to throw everything into the machine, including my ramen-soaked shirt, and then take a nice long shower before settling in for some more of Ari and E's on-screen tension. I took everything off other than my boxer briefs, ran the wash, and headed to my loft where I was out of Teddy's way, hoping he would quit barking. As I made my way to the shower, I heard three things. Teddy's barking, the Entourage theme song playing on repeat over the DVD menu, which consisted of a lot of, oh yes, and the sound of the rain-hail mix inside the garage. I knew that meant my brother forgot to close the garage door when he left, or perhaps the crazy weather got in the way of the sensor and stopped it from shutting. Either way, I wanted to make sure it was closed before I got in the shower, so I went back toward the garage door in my underwear to press the button and ensure things were closed. When I opened the door that led to the garage, Teddy decided to run out, still inside the garage, but no longer inside the house. I freaked out. "Teddy, come here, boy. Come back inside," I said, silently praying he would listen. Instead, he just stood still. I continued to call him, inching my way out the door, closer and closer to him in just my underwear. He wasn't taking my bait and decided to run out into the yard. It was dark and hailing outside, but I couldn't let him run away, not on my watch. I grabbed the nearest boots in the garage, an old pair my brother used for construction, and walked toward Teddy. I knew I would get wet, but I figured it was just the front yard and my health wasn't as concerning as getting this dog inside. Teddy inched farther away from me. The entire relationship with my future sister-in-law flashed before my eyes. She would never forgive me if I was responsible for something happening to her baby, and how could she? The problem is, every time I got closer to Teddy, he scurried, and he was a quick little doggy. I'm no speed racer, and the oversized work boots I had on weren't helping, but I did my best. Pretty soon, I was in the next-door neighbor's yard, then I was down the street, then the next street over, and finally in the woods somewhere, yards away from our home. Teddy was so fast that I couldn't catch up, and although I was able to keep my eye on him for a long stretch, I just couldn't seem to get him to stop or come to me. He was probably terrified that a grown man in his underwear and clown shoes was chasing after him in the rain, but I had no choice. When we got into the woods, I didn't have the assistance of the street lamps to help me see him. It was too dark and too late. Teddy was officially lost. Since I ran out of the house without any clothes, it also meant I didn't have my phone. This was during my cell phone belt clip era, so when I didn't have a waistline, I didn't have my Nokia. Flashbacks of my sixth grade slumber party debacle came rushing in my head. I've been through some shit in my life, but this moment was truly one of the worst because I had no idea what to do. My only glimmer of hope was that I've watched Homeward Bound and Homeward Bound 2 Lost in San Francisco so many times that I knew if Sassy the Cat could survive a waterfall in the West Coast, Teddy could maybe make it through the Ohio rain. I wasn't sure if I should stay in the forest, trembling and almost naked, and hope to find Teddy, or if I should go back home to call for backup, put on some clothes, and find him that way. Neither one seemed all that great, but I opted to head back to the condo. On the way, I walked through the streets yelling his name in case he started to head that way too. He didn't show up, but the headlights on a familiar car did. I squinted behind me at the vehicle driving my way. It was my brother. They decided to skip the movie and come home after dinner. He slowed as he drove close and opened the window. "What the fuck?" he asked. Actually, I'm not sure that those were his exact words, but it was something like that. There was a what the fuck energy to the moment, for sure. I honestly looked crazy, almost naked and soaking wet, but not like in a sexy way. This wasn't Britney's Stronger video. I was a hot mess, and now I had to deliver the bad news to the happy couple. I opened the garage door and Teddy ran out. I tried to run after him, but the words shook out of me, my body in fight or flight mode from the cold night. Seeing their faces left me even colder. There's no easy way to tell someone you lost their dog. I got in the car and they drove me home, telling me to go inside and call my parents to come help look for Teddy and also to put on some clothes while they drove the car back to the wooded area in the neighborhood to look for him. Walking back into the empty house made me wish Teddy were there barking at me. What I would have given to hear the sound of that little doggy instead of the still playing, "Oh yes," of disc one of season 3B of Entourage. My parents lived close by, so they immediately came to help, and so did my other brother and his wife. We all scoured the neighborhood with flashlights, looking for the scared pooch in the pouring rain. As much as I was worried about what this would mean for my relationship with my brother's new girlfriend, I was even more terrified for Teddy being out there all alone at night. I thought about the asshole previous owner who conditioned this beautiful little dog to be so scared of other people. Animal abuse is a larger issue than we have time for here, but it's truly abhorrent that people could treat creatures that way. As our search party perused the streets, I kept apologizing. With fresh clothes on, I was doing my best to focus on our rescue, and eventually, thank God, Mariah Carey, that my dad found Teddy underneath a parked car, shivering close to the back left tire. He was scared, and although he would usually run from men, Teddy this time sat still, allowing my dad to wrap him up and bring him home. I have never felt such relief. He was safe. My brother eventually asked Teddy's mom to move into the condo when I moved off to Chicago. They got married, had 3 kids, and lived happily ever after. Teddy is still around and has calmed down a bit, but not so much with me. When I see him, my energy is completely off, and I think he can sense that. I try my best, bringing him treats for the holidays and petting him as much as he'll let me, but our relationship has been tainted. The memories of that night come flooding back when I see his sweet face, and I'm sure it's the same for him. He barks and I shudder, feeling like I'm back in my underwear running through the sleet-filled street, the sound of the Entourage theme song playing in my head. "Oh yeah," I think to myself in the sing-song way of the DVD menu. A few days after Teddy ran away, my brother and I received a flyer in the mail that had gone out to every mailbox in the neighborhood. It was a grainy image of me that looked like it was taken with a razor phone, the word warning in big bold letters above the photo. A man was seen running through the neighborhood in his underwear, yelling at the top of his lungs, "Please report if seen again," the flyer said. Turns out whoever saw me didn't see Teddy that night either. They simply saw a lunatic on the brink of a breakdown. They saw me for exactly who I was.